We are lucky enough to live, work, and record this podcast on the land of the Kaurna people. We acknowledge their ongoing connection to sea country and the importance of Indigenous knowledge in caring for the ocean.
Welcome to the Ocean Pod, a podcast about all things marine science and the ocean. You're joined by myself, Professor Bronwyn Galanders, and my co-host, Dr. Nina Wooten. We're both marine scientists here at the University of Adelaide with a huge passion for all things ocean. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Bronwyn. In this episode of Ocean Pod, we are talking about some of the ocean's most specialised and arguably least understood reptiles, sea snakes. Sleek, stealthy, and armed with remarkable sensory abilities, sea snakes have evolved an entire toolkit for life in the water, yet they're often overlooked in discussions about marine wildlife. To help us explore their sensory superpowers, strange behaviours, and the challenges they face in a changing ocean, we are joined by Dr. Jenna Crowe-Riddell, an evolutionary biologist here at the University of Adelaide. Jenna's research helps reveal how sea snake brains and senses have evolved, and what this can tell us about how they are living their lives. But first, it's time for Tide Talk. Bronwyn, what's caught your attention this week?
Well, I was recently at a Microplastics in Focus conference in Newcastle that was organised by CRC Care, and it was looking at from environmental impact to practical solutions and some of the innovations and how to mitigate some of the plastic pollution, focused on microplastics, like I mentioned. But also there was a range of conference themes around detection and quantification. And so that was quite incredible what people are actually detecting in the nano range. So very, very tiny. There was bits around sources and transport and fate of microplastics. And there's some NGOs doing great work where they're putting out these kind of plastic things that go in the drain with nets that filter everything
that's
coming in.
Oh, yeah, like kind of like a trash trap kind of thing.
Yeah, but kind of that less than 1 meter square, like you could carry it onto the stage and show people what
cool.
It looked like.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then they've also, as part of that, they've been quantifying some of the rubbish that goes into those, but also the microplastics that they find in those. I obviously talked about microplastics in the seafood supply chain. There was other people talking about some of the work that they were doing in other areas. Quite a lot happening around soil, agricultural soils.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I feel like I thought a few years ago that would start becoming a bit of a thing.
Yeah, it's starting to. And then there was also bits around human health risks where we're detecting microplastics in humans. But again, a lot of the people that tend to be focused in that area are more coming not necessarily from the microplastics, but from more the pollutant, environmental like contaminant kind of background. But yeah, really interesting.
Cool.
Unfortunately, my flight home wasn't quite so interesting.
I know. And then you got delayed and we had our work Christmas party on Saturday. We went to some wineries and Bronwyn had to come a little bit late because she'd been delayed and stuck in Melbourne.
Stuck in Melbourne overnight.
What happened? There was a fire in the airport.
There's a fire in the terminal, apparently. And so we landed right, I think, when it was happening and got stuck on the tarmac for a good few hours.
How did I have a fire in the terminal?
I'm not sure.
Crazy.
Anyway, we should go to you, Nina. So what's your Tide Talk for the week, Nina?
So I, last week, went to the Australian Marine Science Association, which is known as AMSA, more commonly to us marine scientists in Australia. The South Australian branch had an event on last Thursday night while you were in Newcastle at the conference.
Yes, I was disappointed I couldn't go to that because it's a good way to catch up with people.
Yeah, it's such a good way to catch up with people. But they do a really good job, AMSA, in SA, of doing events that have something associated with it. So we actually went over to the museum and we went to the Nature Photographer of the Year exhibition.
Oh,
amazing.
Awesome.
The winning photo is underwater, so you can go have a look. It's really cool. It's like an underwater photo of coral. It's like they've gotten their camera and put it underneath the coral and it's going up. It's beautiful. I'll see if I can try to put it in the show notes, actually, because I think it's like a great photo.
If you took a photo, you might be able to.
Yeah, photo of a photo. So that I think I did take a photo, actually. So that we went to that, and then we also went over to a social catch-up, and they had a talk there by some underwater photographers called Down Under Pics, and they taught us about how to take better underwater photos.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
It was really cool.
And, like, did they give you advice on GoPro or those sorts of cameras?
Well,
or?
Actually, yes. Maybe I could provide the advice to our listeners as well. One of our students, one of our PhD master students here at uni, asked what camera would you recommend for a beginner? And unfortunately, the camera, they said a lot of people use their phones now underwater. You must be able to get good cases.
You can get these cases that look to me like they might leak, but
yeah, I would not risk it. I would not risk it. We have the I think it's called a TG7, which is a small underwater camera that you can use. And they actually recommended not getting that because apparently it's too much of a beginner camera. But I sort of disagree with that comment, to be honest, because I feel like if you're just there to be doing some underwater photography while you're diving and not focused on the photos, because the one they recommended as like an entry level was nearly $2,000.
Oh, really?
And it had a whole light set up and it was too, I think it's too big for what, if you're like myself who is going for a dive to enjoy it, if I see something cool, I take a photo. I think that's a different type of diver who's going to take the photos and the whole time they're sitting still with a big camera.
I have an Osmo Action 6 that I got recently. So I compared the Osmo Action 6 to the GoPro and then decided that I like the colour. Depends what sort of colour you like. But there's images online, videos online where people have got both cameras and they're just going through the water and then you can look at them together.
You mean the colour of the photo it's taking, not the colour of the external feature?
Yeah, the colour of the photo. I'm not quite so obsessed by...
with the colour, I was going to say.
We
have a TG7 and I love it. And I would recommend it to anyone. So it depends on what you were after, honestly. I think these people that were hosting, they were great, but they obviously take a lot of very professional photography. Yeah. And if you're just after it for social media or for showing family and friends, something like what you have or the TG7 or a GoPro is probably fine.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know enough about it, to be honest, so maybe don't take my advice. But otherwise, before we get into this episode, I just wanted to quickly jump in as well and say that this will be our last episode for the year. We won't be back in your ears until early Feb. Bronwyn is heading off to Iraq, actually, for a few weeks. When are you leaving?
Next week.
Next week to Iraq. Wow, that will be very fun.
Cradle of civilization. Yes. It'll be amazing. Marshes. I'm really looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, stay safe over there. And I'm actually going to Komodo Island in Indonesia for all of January to do my dive master. So... at least I'll have some cool things to talk about in Tide Talk next year.
Yeah, you will. Doing lots of diving. When you're doing your dive master, they might not let you take cameras underwater with you.
Yeah, I think we're doing some days of fun diving. So
okay,
I'll try to take some photos.
That's good. Cool.
But yeah, we'll report back on our travels when we get back. And yeah, we'll be in your ears in February.
And Merry Christmas to everybody.
Yes, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Today's episode, we're going to learn all about the absolutely captivating world of sea snakes, perhaps one of the least understood reptiles on the planet. To help us unravel their sensory superpowers, behaviours and the challenges they face, we are joined by Dr. Jenna Crowe-Riddell, an evolutionary biologist here at the University of Adelaide. Jenna's research brings together cutting-edge imaging, genomics and behavioural work to reveal how sea snake brains and senses have evolved and what this can tell us about their lives in an ever-changing ocean. Jenna, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We're excited to have Jenna on. So Jenna, we always begin by asking our guests to tell us about how they first started loving the ocean. Now, I don't know if there's a story behind why you love the ocean because you're a bit of a different one, like more of an evolutionary biologist rather than a marine scientist. But is there like, did you grow up near the beach or has it been more of a love for science that has gotten you into sea snakes?
Yeah, I grew up in Canberra. So
no beach.
The one thing that would improve Canberra the most would be a beach.
Yeah.
I've always thought that.
Don't you like though?
Like Burley Griffin.
Yeah, they have a lovely lake. No, but so I grew up just outside of Canberra.
Okay.
So it's on the way to the coast. So if you drive east, you get to Batemans Bay.
Oh, beautiful.
I've travelled a bit to many different places and I still think that's probably the most beautiful beach area you can get to in the world, the Sapphire Coast, honestly. So, yeah, lots of memories going there as a kid. I was a water baby. My brother's a water baby. We just love water. So when I got interested in science, it was through biology and animals, and I was just naturally gravitated towards marine stuff. So I did have a bit of a plan of I want to be a marine biologist, but I didn't necessarily end up in that spot, though I do work on marine animals. So I see what you mean by, I've got that evolutionary interest that drives me.
Yeah, it's kind of adjacent.
Yeah. Cool.
So let's talk about sea snakes then. For listeners who might not know much about them, what exactly is a sea snake and how are they different from land snakes? And then there's also sea crates, aren't there?
Yeah, great question. Number one, they are snakes. You've asked that if they are snakes, if they're different from land snakes, but I often get the question, are they fish? Are they eels? So I thought I'd start there.
Yeah, let's start there.
So they're not an eel because that's a fish and they are a snake. So they can look a lot like an eel. They've, got that elongated body form, but they are snakes, which means that they had to move from a land-based environment into the water at some point in their evolutionary history. And they're different from sea crates, which also move from land to sea, but at a different time. So sea snakes moved from land to sea about 20 million years ago, and that was from terrestrial ancestors. Things like what probably look like a brown snake or tiger snakes, that's sort of the closest relatives. Whereas with sea crates, they moved a little bit earlier in the timeline and probably diverged from venomous, Papuan elapids, so slightly different geographical place that they entered from.
Okay, because I always thought, and maybe I'm wrong, that sea crates went back on land to breed.
They do. So then, they have several differences. So sea crates lay eggs, so that means they have to come to land just like a sea turtle would, or even crocodiles. These really aquatic animals must return to lay eggs. So sea crates are the same. They even mate on land, whereas sea snakes give birth to live young.
Oh, cool. They give birth to live young.
Yeah.
So that's evolved differently to land snakes.
Yeah. Well, okay. Some land snakes can... Reptiles are really funny, especially lizards and snakes. They kind of just flip back and forth between do you want to lay eggs or do you want to be live-bearing, as in different species will have the different ways, but even within a species they might, over a lifetime choose to do different things. So they're really variable compared to, say, mammals, which obviously just give birth to live young. That's their thing. So, yeah, probably the ancestor gave birth to live young and was probably a really important feature that led to their success, because the other key difference between sea snakes and land snakes is that there's many more sea snakes. There's over 60 species and we're still discovering more, whereas with sea crates there's only 8 species, although there might be a couple more. It's a lot less.
I didn't know we had 60 species of sea snakes. That's crazy.
Yeah, and they're really diverse. They do different things. They're doing eating different things in the water, different habitats, seagrass beds, coral reef, sandy bottoms, things that you think maybe nothing might be there. They're there.
Yeah.
They can even dive really deep to the mesophotic zone, so they can dive a lot deeper than we used to think they could. So that's, maximum 250 metres?
Yeah.
Wow.
So they can access a lot of habitats. And sea crates are also very, very good at being in the water, don't get me wrong, but that's a key sort of biological difference. Between them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then a sea snake, they have to breathe still.
Yes, exactly. So just like a whale, used to have terrestrial ancestors a long, long time ago. They have to surface to breathe. So they still have lungs, right? They don't have gills. The sea snakes are the same. They have this one elongate lung, which a lot of snakes have, because they have to sort of squeeze all their organs into this one big tube, so they just have one lung. But then in the sea snakes, it's sort of pocketed out to create this sort of buoyancy gas bladder, if you like. Not as sophisticated as a fish, but something like that to give them some buoyancy in the water. But periodically they'll have to come up and and breathe air at the surface. But they can also take some oxygen and release some nitrogen as they dive through their skin.
Okay.
Wow. But so that's what's scary about when you're snorkeling and there's sea snakes around us. They have to come up to breathe, and so they can be right beside your face.
Yeah, right in there.
That's it. It's kind of convenient for us because we can scoop them off the top of the water because they're coming up to breathe.
I did have a question which was about what makes them so fascinating to study, but I feel like you've definitely listed a few things already. I'm really interested.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, I can tell you why I was fascinated
by
them.
Yeah, why are you fascinated?
I would say I wasn't a snake person. I mean, I am now, but I was a marine person, so I was volunteering for marine field work thinking, yeah, sea turtles, let's work on sea. No one works on sea turtles. Of course, everybody does because they're beautiful. So I ended up on this trip, but we saw a couple species of sea turtles. We saw a lot more sea snakes. And this was in an area of Australia that's quite remote, actually in the Timor Sea, a place called Ashmore Reef and surrounding areas, Hibernia Reef. These really, like, I don't know, it takes 24 hours on a boat to get there. But what was clear to me and what really drew me to sea snakes was I could tell immediately the diversity of species. So different shapes, colours, head shapes, and different places they were swimming in and eating in. And that just drew me to them. I was like, these guys are more interesting. As an evolutionary biologist, I was like, there's more questions here,
yeah.
I thought, and maybe a niche.
That's very cool.
So they've got
some remarkable sensory abilities. What are the key senses that they rely on, and how do these differ from their terrestrial relatives?
Yeah, I like the way you frame that question, because in my research I'm always using the base of, okay, what did their ancestors, so the terrestrial, they would have been terrestrial, what do they look like? And so we can look at their current living relatives, like the tiger snake, the brown snake, and then see how things adapted over time. So that comparable context is really important. So if we look at, say, a brown snake, vision's really important, but also you can see snakes stick out their tongue a lot, their forked tongue. That is unique to snakes mostly, and that's a really specialized sense. So it's kind of like smelling, but it's actually a completely different pathway. So it's chemoreception, but it doesn't go via the nose. And that's important for, like, finding mates and prey and assessing, all sorts of different information from conspecific. So, like, their, you know, other females or males and young and things like that. So you've got this chemical sense that's really, really well developed in snakes. And so how has that changed is a huge question. So most of the time when we see an animal go from land to sea, smell just disappears. It's just too hard. It's air-based. I think it's just too much. Changes have to happen. But when you have a forked tongue, it's actually already a sort of liquid-based thing because it's in the mouth. You know what I mean? So they actually have exploded in all their receptors related to that forked tongue sense. We don't exactly know why or how, what that means for them, but that is super important. And then their vision is still important, but what some research has found is that their sensitivity to different wavelengths has changed. So whereas the tiger snake or brown snake will be sensitive to the visible light spectrum, kind of violet light, the sea snakes, that same pigment that would have been sensitive to violet light has now shifted in its spectral sensitivity. So in the sea snakes, it can sense blue wavelengths, and you shifted from like a UV violet to blue. And that actually makes sense for what we know about the aquatic environment. Blue light travels a lot further, whereas the other parts of the spectra attenuate quite quickly at depths.
Wow.
Yeah. So
there's so much going on there.
There's
amazing.
A lot. Yeah.
Something that I've always actually wondered about, and I did study evolutionary biology, so I should probably know more, but for our listeners as well, probably helpful. So we're talking, like, when did the sea snake first evolve, did you say?
15 to 20 million years ago.
So are we just thinking, like, one day a land snake is just on the land and then it just goes into the water and then it somehow survives and then it just keeps on making more? Is that what happened?
Yeah, well, kind of, but over, you add time.
Okay.
Add many, many generations and every little step along the way to get to that point.
Okay.
So if we look at living snakes and where we find them, they're actually really well adapted to water. If you put I've seen a video, a colleague was in, I think Costa Rica or Panama, grabbed a tree snake, popped it in this drain that was running outside of their hotel, and it just starts swimming. No problems. Oh. Swam out, back up the tree. So you'd think this is a tree snake, superbly adapted to, you know, climbing amongst foliage, yet it can swim. So it's got this beautiful serpentine body shape,
yeah.
which eels have, right? It's anguilliform. It's perfect for swimming. So you already have this sort of, I guess you could call it pre-adaptation. But the real question is, why did they stay? Why did they linger? How did they become so successful in this environment when other snakes, although we have lots of snakes that, you know, tiger snakes happy to forage in fresh water and eat a fish underwater.
Really?
Yeah, I've seen some things. It's amazing.
And red-bellied blacks.
Red-bellied blacks, exactly.
Snakes are known for the water.
Yeah.
And I do actually remember one of our students when they were doing some fight netting in the river systems catching a brown snake.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah, yeah.
You see them underwater. They're
I wouldn't want to see them underwater.
I know, well, but that's essentially what a sea snake is, but they've just, you know, adapted a few things, you know, and so to become successful at living in the sea, they've got this cutaneous respiration, so that was the breathing through the skin I talked about. They've got paddle-shaped tails now, so they can swim even more efficiently. Obviously, their senses have changed, like I talked about, but there's still a lingering question for an evolutionary biologist, like what makes some groups more successful than others? Like why are the sea crates only have 8 species, but the sea snakes have over 60? I still don't really know the answer to those questions.
Actually, I have a question about the 60 sea snakes. How many of these are in Australia?
Yeah, good question. I'm going to say, don't quote me, I feel like 25 to 30 are in Australia.
Okay.
So their range, we think they probably evolved in Australia, northwest Australia, because there's a really high level of endemism.
What's endemism?
So endemism means this species is found nowhere else. So we've got these unique little species with really small ranges all up in that interesting part of the world I mentioned, the Timor Sea and and sort of around Broome area and the Kimberley. But then once they got in the water, so to speak, once they evolved and became successful in colonising these different habitats under there, they spread really quite quickly all through Southeast Asia, so all the way up to India, and even we get a few species that get to the Gulf of Oman, and then one species that can make it all the way down to the southern tip of Africa.
Oh, wow.
And that's the most widely distributed tetrapod. So tetrapod means something that was on the land once. Now I've gone back because it goes from the southern tip of Africa and then goes all the way through Southeast Asia, all along the Pacific and reaches Costa Rica.
Whoa.
Wow, that's really widely distributed, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so that's managed to do that because it's a species that floats along the ocean current. So it's a truly pelagic species of sea snake just on the surface, and it mimics, you know, flotsam, waits for a small pelagic fish to take shelter under it, and then it'll snap it up.
Oh.
That's an evolutionary behaviour, potentially, that it's developed them, because that's pretty clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. And then they're not in SA.
No, although we've had a couple records wash up. I should say they're mostly restricted to subtropical, tropical regions, because like all reptiles, they rely on external temperatures to regulate their internal body.
So with climate change, are they moving further south?
That's a really great question. Yeah, obviously a lot of marine species are doing that. I don't know. There's records of individual species sort of popping up in an El Nino, but that's still a question we don't really know the answer to. You'd assume they would, but there's some – we have a student, not one of mine, but in another research group, Laura Murray, and she's tracking individual movements of sea snakes to see how they respond to climate differences. And something she's noticed is if depending on how deep their habitat goes, if it's in the first 20, 30 metres, the temperature is not that different. But if its habitat extends to deeper depths, you're going to get to colder temperatures. So we had a recording I mentioned before of a sea snake that got down to 250 metres and it was 14 degrees down there. So that's basically at the thermal limit of what we understand sea snakes can operate at. So my point is maybe they can thermoregulate, which means they can move up and down the water column. So maybe they've got behaviours that buffer them against some big range shifts.
I guess also when you get things moving south, it's the larvae and then they start developing there and breeding up. So sea snakes might not be quite, that might be the odd individual moving, but not
that's
yet.
That's it. We call them waves. So you definitely see rafts of waves pop up in a particularly hot season. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you'll get some washing up in Tasmania. New Zealand has got some and it's quite cold down there.
Wow.
But whether they can establish is a great question. So they obviously have to have things that they'll eat. there as well.
And then a mate as well.
That's it. Very important things.
I want to talk a bit now about some of your actual research, because I feel like we just had a crash course in sea snakes and I learned a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of information there that I probably should have already known, but that's all right. I'm learning as I go. So you do a lot of work looking at sea snake brains and also their senses.
Yes.
And how they evolve. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the most surprising adaptations or features that you have discovered in your research?
I think the most surprising one, so I started out my research looking at senses in sea snakes. That led me to brains, and I can talk about that in a minute. But the most surprising sense, which might not even really relay to their brain, is their ability to sense light in their tail. Yeah, so I mentioned they've got this paddle tail, it's a nice big wide tail. And when they're sleeping during the day, that paddle tail will be tucked away really nicely. But if you go out on the reef at night, that tail will be exposed and floating around. So some researchers back in 1990, you know, the year I was born basically, went out and put some torchlight on these tails and found that they only would remove their tail out of the light, nothing else, even when their eyes were out of view. So they repeated that, and it was a really strong response. It wasn't just a fluke. This one species called the olive sea snake just kept responding to light in that way. So for my PhD, I found this obscure study and I was like, oh, that's an interesting thing. So I repeated the study and yes, sure enough, all of sea snakes do respond. But the surprising thing is that other species do it too, but not all the sea snakes. So their closest relatives do. So there's a couple other, you know, a brown line sea snake that's a really nice elongate sea snake. It also does it and it responds to its body as well. But most of the other sea snakes don't. And that was surprising because I'm like, well, they all have paddle tails. They all need to stay concealed during the day, presumably from their natural predators like sharks or, you know, even predatory reef fishes will take a bite out of a sea snake. But only this small group of sea snakes do. And then through looking at their evolutionary tree, I tracked the, you know, most likely origin of the trait, which meant basically only 10 species have it out of the 60. So
whoa.
Really
so
low
are
amount.
They phylogenetically closely related?
That's correct.
Yeah, so they probably all evolved.
At some point, yeah, it originated. Mm. And so when we looked across other animals, it's a really rare ability. So you're sensing light independent of your eye and you have a very stereotyped behaviour, so you're withdrawing something away. And that does occur in other animals, and they happen to also be aquatic animals but really distantly related to sea snakes. Talking separated by 400 million years of evolution. So that's right back to the origin of vertebrates. So these other animals are hagfishes.
Oh, yeah.
Slimy ones, exactly. Lampreys. So these are really weird vertebrates. They're odd-looking things. But they are elongate. They have paddle-shaped tails, and they hide themselves. With the lampreys, it's just their juvenile form that has it. And then jump around to amphibians, again, another whole part of the tree, not really closely related to these fishes at all. A couple salamanders, which are aquatic, have elongate bodies, paddle-shaped tails, hide themselves in freshwater, also have this ability to sense light on their tail. So you see this really rare trait pop up when there's this ecological need, but it's still very rare. And even in the sea snakes, it's only happened once. So as an evolutionary biologist, this is a mystery to me, because it's why something, you know, if it can be selected for, we're talking about something that's ecologically beneficial, why wouldn't it be in all of them? So then we come to ideas of chance events and how difficult things might be to change, or how flexible systems are, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I also looked at genes expressed in the tail. So I used lots of different methods. So I was looking at behavior. I did try and look at anatomy, but I did not find any particular receptor that made them sensitive. But the genetics was really interesting, because you could look at genes expressed in the skin. And what I found there was these visual pigments that are, actually, sorry, non-visual pigments that are expressed in the eye but aren't related to vision, but they're expressed, that is, they're, like, active in the skin on the tail of these snakes.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah. So you've touched on gene expression, but you also use some of the micro-CT scanning things. How do these help you address the questions that you want around senses?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I've studied a few different senses, and after my PhD, when I had an opportunity to research them in my postdoc, I was thinking, that's all very well and good. I can look at individual senses, but really an animal doesn't ever use one sense, right? We are speaking, so we're hearing, we're looking at each other, we're seeing, we can feel things, we can feel the chair under us. So all of these combine and are integrated in the brain. So it led me to the brain because that's really this process. It is the processing center of all these senses. So should help us understand in a more holistic way how senses change over evolution, but also how that animal actually uses them in different proportions or different importance in their lives. Mm-hmm. So the micro CT scanning I do is you pop a museum specimen into a CT scanner, you'll get all their bones. So you can get amazing information on their skulls and vertebrae. But if before you put it in the scanner, you put a contrasting agent, so that's iodine in this case. So if you go to the doctor, you get an MRI, you'll get this contrasting agent put through you. And basically what that does is it lights up all of the other anatomy. I'm talking like the soft tissue, that's brains and eyes, but also muscles, fat, like all this other stuff. So we're doing these CT scans and I could see it all. I could see a venom gland, I could see the tongue, I could see these eyes and ears and brain. And if you look at brains in a comparative way across different snakes or any animal, you'll start seeing changes in the shape or proportion of different regions of the brain. And so different regions of the brain have functional importance. So there's a region of the brain that would, you know, process smell. There's a region of the brain that will process vision. And then there's another region that will integrate those together. So by studying the brain through this amazing imaging, we're getting these really data-rich specimens that can tell us about the holistically how the snake sensory world is changing. Do you know what I mean? So I'm just getting, I want more and more data, and I'm really excited about this imaging because there's so much more we can see in it as well. It's not just restricted to what I'm interested in, right?
That sounds amazing. So you can take, like, are these specimens dried specimens or they're in some sort of solution in museums?
Yeah, they have to be sort of, you could call them pickled, embalmed.
Okay.
Pickled. So, yeah.
If they're
dried.
Formalin or something.
Exactly, yeah. Formalin and then ethanol. So museums keep animals, they've been keeping them for hundreds of years, and we can actually take a specimen if it's been preserved well. We've scanned specimens from, I think, the earliest is the 1920s. This is when I was doing research in Michigan. So they had amazing collections that stretch back quite a way and just gorgeous, amazing quality if they're kept well.
That's amazing that you can use them and that saves you having to collect specimens today because they're there already.
Exactly. So my hope is that if we image enough, we can then sort of build up a bank of data. And this data is as dense and rich as genomic scale sequencing. So it's a revolution in terms of, you know, for studying morphology, that is how animals look and anatomy. So once we bank that up, we could start characterizing different animals by their configuration of senses and brains, and we might understand how they view the world, how they interact with the world, and then what makes them potentially at risk of different, you know, all sorts of different pressures.
Fascinating. So if we could experience the ocean the way a sea snake does, what would their sensory world feel like?
Such a good question. This is why I love sensory biology. It's this understanding of the world so separate from ours. It's the like link, the window into other animals' perception, because that perception is their world, right? So there's this idea of Umwelt in sensory biology, whereas that's the only thing that exists is what you can sense creates your inner world. So I do often imagine it. So what do we know? First thing is you enter the water, suddenly you have this buoyant media around you. So you're going to be sort of going in all sorts of different directions. So their senses might have to help them understand which way's up and down a lot more than we would on land. Then you have swirling chemicals going in all sorts of these odor plumes that form, right? And then you have sound as well. So these travel really differently underwater than they do in the air. So we can even think about this when we put our head underwater. You can hear things differently. But sound actually travels better, so potentially they can hear sound better. We don't really know much about how sea snakes hear. Then we have the chemical, these odor plumes. So are they finding fish that they eat this way? Are they finding mates this way? Are they maybe anticipating a shark coming by or other alarm cues that other fishes are putting out, so there's alarm signals? And then they have this really different opportunity that we don't really have in the air or on land, which is touch. So we can touch things if we come in contact with them, but animals in the ocean can touch things if the other animal moves, say a fish moves its flipper, it'll create a ripple through the water, right? So now you can detect this ripple. And so fishes and sharks have this lateral line and they've got a superb sense of feeling water motion. So if you try to catch a fish with your hands, they can feel you coming. They don't have to see you. They can feel that water motion moving. So sea snakes have this ability as well. So they've got these little touch receptors all over their face that have become really enlarged and different shapes. And we think that's to detect water motion, so either of prey or predators or other snakes. So they might be incredibly sensitive all over their face and body.
Wow, to be a sea snake. That actually really gave me a bit of insight into what it would be like. I think, do snakes have ears?
Yeah. Well, if you look at a snake, it's famously no. That's the difference between them and lizards, other than the limb thing. They don't have limbs, but you can't see an external ear opening. So that can't let air in, or if a sea snake can't let water in. But underneath that, they still have an inner ear, just like any other vertebrates. So they can process sound, but it has to be, you know, their bones and form a conduit to that sound. So they can basically hear really low vibrations. Okay. So for a sea snake, a land snake, if it puts its jaw on the ground, which almost always has its jaw on the ground, it can hear vibrations through the ground that get to the jaw that set those bones vibrating that then goes to the inner ear without it having to go through this outer ear opening.
Hey.
Does that make sense?
That's how they say to stomp around.
That's exactly right. So for a sea snake, though, they don't have their bones on the ground. They're just floating around. But like I said, sound travels extremely well in water. So if that's surrounding you, then your lung or the tissue next to your ear can vibrate at that same frequency. But even so, it's a pretty low frequency that they're sensitive to. But we think they would probably be sensitive to quite loud noises. Yeah.
Wow, I find this so interesting. you do lots of cool field work as well, a lot of it over on the Ningaloo Reef as well. Have you got any memorable or unexpected encounters? And also, while we're in there, are sea snakes are venomous, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Very venomous.
Okay.
Very venomous. It's the least interesting thing about them. No, everyone asked me that. Yeah, they are venomous.
I thought they were, but
I didn't even mention that. Yeah.
They just can't get their mouths open wide enough to bite.
That's the myth.
Oh,
that is the common myth if you ask any fisherman or...
Oh, Bronwyn's been scuba diving.
Scuba diver. I think it's just to make us feel better because they don't often bite. But if they were to bite, they are very capable of biting. Just like any other snake, they can open their jaws really wide.
Oh, really? So that's a good myth. That should link to our myths.
Yeah, our myths. We did an episode last episode was on busting some ocean myths.
So that's a good big one.
I think it's just because they're reluctant to bite. But in my line of work, if you're pulling them out of the water to take a DNA sample or whatever you want to do, they're very happy to bite.
Okay.
I think I should stop listening at this point.
But we take all the safety precautions. We've never had any bite us. Yeah. It's all about handling them safely. And you know, you get people in herpetology, so people who study snakes, get this bravado about them, very happy to, you know, make snakes bite or open their mouths, and we don't do any of that.
No, when you're doing field work.
No, we don't take those risks, yeah.
So do you have any memorable unexpected encounters?
I mean, I probably do. I mean, it's going to be a really cliche answer, but, you know, obviously in Ningaloo Reef there's just so many whales, whales. And it's to the point where you just get bored of them. Have you ever had that?
No. I have not.
It's still special, but you're like, oh. So, yeah.
Bored of a humpback whale, Jenna.
But all the females will come in and then the babies are there and they'll do this thing called logging where they'll just.
Oh, wow. That sounds incredible.
Yeah. They're just floating at the surface. And so you have to go quite slow in the boat to really look out for them. And, of course, they'll be breaching and all the rest. And it's an incredible place to be. You feel so special there.
Yeah. I think I'd better go to Ningaloo Reef. I've never been there. But whale sharks as well.
Exactly, yeah. Hmm. I have not actually seen a whale shark. I need to I'm too busy looking for sea snakes.
Yeah, oh, you're preoccupied.
It is funny how you get this vision for what you're studying or what you're after and you
forget, a bit
blinkered to everything else.
Yeah.
But you've touched on how working with wild sea snakes sounds challenging, and you have touched a little bit on how you study them safely and ethically. But have you got more about that safe kind of challenging sort of field work?
Maybe just tell people not to handle a sea snake.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Yeah. yeah, we obviously take safety really, really seriously of the snake as well as all the workers, right? So we have a pretty strict process in place. A lot of that's around PPE, so personal protective equipment and things like that. So we wear gloves, we wear long pants and boots. But perhaps more importantly, I think, is a willingness to support each other to be safe. Because whenever you look up, you know, any of these, whenever a herpetologist has been bitten by a snake, often it's, you know, they were just tired or they thought it was a snake that wasn't venomous and made a mistake. And obviously those mistakes could be fatal. So we spend a lot of time just double checking, okay, is there a snake in here? What's our system?
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually really boring. Do we get to the point where this isn't, you don't have any adrenaline? This is a very run-of-the-mill, because it's so boring because we've got so many layers of protection. But that's the important part, because it's the human behavior that brings in the risk, I think. Because you can kind of understand, you know, bringing a snake out of water, you're putting it in a net, it's on land, how you, if you're going to handle it, how that might affect it. You know it's going to be stressed, so you're aware of that risk quite acutely. But the risk comes more about how people act. So if someone's going to do something stupid, or they're just going to go, I'm just going to have a quick look at this snake. And so we always tell each other, because you never handle snakes alone, is, hey, are you going to handle snakes? I'll come with you. Like, you know, just reminding each other of what that system is.
That sounds good, because you're always also on a potentially rocking boat, aren't you?
So
it's not like it's just a stable on land
platform. Yeah, but it's that checking in with your field team.
Yeah, definitely. Communication.
Yeah.
So I think that some sea snake species, from my limited reading or understanding of them, are a bit under risk of, you know, different threats and pressures, as a lot of our ocean is. Can you just tell us a little bit about how understanding their senses and the neural adaptations and all the work that you're doing can help us better protect them as we go forward into a changing environment as well?
Yeah. So where my work comes in, I think it comes in two places. One, we sort of talked about how senses, or understanding senses, are how you understand the most fundamental questions about what an animal does or what motivates an animal. So questions like, where am I going to find shelter? How am I going to find prey? How do I find mates? How do I avoid a predator? Really fundamental questions for any animal. So my kind of, you might call it basic research, is about understanding how that animal views their world, how they then can interact with it. So it's sort of basic knowledge. And that's important because although some sea snakes have clear endangered profile, most sea snakes are unknown. So in the IUCN assessment, about a quarter of sea snakes just have data deficient next to them.
Wow.
And so we still need to know some really basic things about where are they, what are they doing, what motivates them. The second area where I see neural understanding of animal behaviour come in is in sort of a framework that sensory ecologists are coming around, which is understanding an environment through the animal's eyes. So we can come along and find different markers of what an environment is. So it could be salinity or temperature, all these different things, or, you know, coverage of corals and invertebrates, all that sort of important markers. But what's important to the animal, that species, could be very, very different depending how they're interacting and sensing that world. So you can have a sensory framework over the top of it and find these what we call sensory danger zones. So, for example, if you have a bit of coastal development that's creating a lot of noise, that's going to impact whales a lot. We know that because they use sound to communicate. But it might not affect animals that are deaf or barely use it. So where do sea snakes sit in that for very specific, what you might call sensory pollutants? So like chemicals or sound, you know, really, really loud sound or sustained vibration. Because we don't know enough about their basic anatomy. We can't say in these risk assessments, or if the government wants to put a policy in place, oh, where do sea snakes sit in this? We actually can't tell them because we have no data.
Mm.
And so it's really powerful to...
That sounds so interesting.
Yeah.
We can talk about this after the episode.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in that.
Yeah.
So we're getting towards the end, but have you got any parting advice to young, interested marine scientists or evolutionary biologists who may be listening and think, wow, what an amazing career to have. How do I have that sort
of
career?
How do I get on Ningaloo Reef catching sea snakes?
That's exactly it. Well, reflecting on my own story, like how I got into it, is I keep yourself really open. Because I think I had a very particular, well, I like biology, I like the ocean, I look around, okay, sea turtles, that's it. But actually, you know, I opened myself up to different opportunities, so I volunteered on different things, and it was on one of those volunteer trips that I discovered sea snakes and discovered the researchers who are studying them, and that's what got me into it. So it's not exactly a clear path, so it's hard to make advice out of that, but I guess in a more broad sense, follow that curiosity, and it may not lead you to where you thought it, you know, you thought you were going to go, but it will always, the answer will always be interesting. I think in science,
there's so many different areas you could end up in, aren't there? So if you keep it broad and you do take up all the opportunities you can, then something exciting is bound to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Do you want me to say not to handle snakes? I realise I didn't say that.
No, it's all right. I think we've made it pretty clear.
Good.
I think we've made that clear enough. Don't handle the snakes. But thank you so much. That was amazing.
You're welcome. Yeah,
I was so passionate.
Yes.
You're so clever. I feel like you're so well-spoken. Very composed.
If you've got questions, cool ocean facts or stories to share, get in touch with us on social media or email. You can find our details in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoyed this episode, follow Ocean Pod wherever you listen and leave us a review. It really helps other ocean lovers find us.
Music written and performed by Seamus Nicholas. Graphic design by Rhiannon Van Eck. This podcast is produced by us, Nina and Bronwyn. Supported by the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide.